school and an international independent news hour. But it was in the rain, so they got out. And then they told Carlos that his son was dead. He died in the ancient Rocky City of Anatolia at the age of 20 years, 20 days. And Carlos lost his mind. He went into a great frenzy. He begged the Marines to leave. They didn't beg again. They didn't. He raced the garage, got his cans of gas, got one of these blowtorches, asked them to leave again. They didn't. And he went to them and started to try to wreck it. And he threw gasoline from the van and he got it over himself and some other can out. And it was trying to pull them out of the van, and triggered the torch, the whole thing blew up. And he was lying out to the lawn burning. At which point, his wife immediately pulled out. They found her husband burning on the lawn and their son, and her husband was dead. And then their son, Brian, their younger son, called. He was on vacation in Maine, 17 years old. He was calling his dad to wish him a happy birthday. Someone turned out the cell phone and they heard the ringing, heard this massive commotion, and heard their stress. And someone turned out the TV where he was in Maine and saw his father running along. And that's where he learned that his older brother, who he loved and emulated and wanted to be, was dead. One story, no objection. One story in his time of war. It took Carlos a long time. He was burning over a quarter of his body, but the physical wasn't the problem. It was emotional. A year later, in August of 2005, Cindy Sheehan went to Crawford and Carlos had gone to the back of Cindy Sheehan. On August 5th, 2005, she addressed the Dallas Veterans for Peace. It was pretty spontaneous, what she said. She said since she knew she couldn't enjoy another vacation, her son Casey died in Sauter City, 4-4-04, April 4, 2004, she says. She said she would go to Crawford, where the president was starting on the longest vacations in presidential history. And she wanted to go to ask for an hour at a time. She wanted him to answer the question for what noble cause did he ask on that. She said since she was in Texas, she'd go the next morning. She didn't know where Crawford was, but she figured it's Texas, how far it could be. They started out in a little caravan and they ate their way to the presidential estate. We won't call it a ranch. And she showed up residence in a ditch right outside the property. And she just kept asking that question. What noble cause did my son die? Now, the White House press corps is, well, embedded. Whether on the front lines of troops in Iraq or in the White House, it comes to the same thing. All too many cases. But where even that captured press corps in the heat of a Texas summer, 110 degree weather, when they weren't enjoying the access of evil, that's true and true for access, because the president was on vacation. And here was this persistent, relentless woman right down the road from them who wouldn't stop asking that question. And finally, they put it to the press. And this shows the power of the press. When they ask a question, that so many outside don't enjoy that access or asking. And they asked him why he would give an hour to spend with this mourning mother. And he responded, I have to get on with my life too. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote that day that he had gone on a mountain bike ride for 2 hours, fished, got into a little league luncheon, napped, and then hardly did some reading. And Cindy if you listen to or watch Montana. And by the way, how many of you listen to it on WCRU?
Yeah!
On WOW. How many of you watch it on Chicago Penn, Channel 19, every morning at 7? How many of you see it on Cruise TV, Channel 9415, Dish Network? How many on 9411 TV? Or on DirecTV, Channel 375? How many of you podcast it at democracynow.org or on iTunes? How many of you listen to the podcast? How many of you watch the video podcast? By the way, Time Magazine just said that Democracy Now! And Tim Russert's NBC's Meet the Press are the two most popular podcasts.
Thank you.
sure what Scott was saying. You're a story when they pulled out that money, so they saw thousands of times, and Rachel was out in front. He saw that picture of the rope head of the statue on the council many times. He said he wants to take a piece of that statue and embed it in the foundation of the new World Trade Center. If he does that, that will be the first proven link.
Been in vacation for more than a year of his nine office.
So he didn't leave Crawford, but he went to California. And he has picture taken, these pictures he allowed, strumming the guitar of the country music singer, Mark Wills. His signature song, Wish You Were Here, could have been the theme song of the League of New Orleans. And then he flew back, not to New Orleans, but to Charlotte. It wasn't only President Bush to respond. His vice president, Cheney, was in Wyoming, the flying mission vacation, Monday, November, and Tuesday, left, or Wednesday, they're also on vacation. Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, was in New York, was behind, she shot in it. A customer goes, what are you doing shopping when people in New Orleans are drowning, and they took her out? The customer, that is. She's looking at the walkway plane, Salmon, she played tennis with Monica. We're talking well past the reach of levees and hurricanes. And then there was Andrew Card, he was the chief of staff, former GM office, vacationing in New England, former GM office. Yes, what we've seen in Washington is the ascendancy of the oil party. You've got President Bush available, and Vice President Cheney, former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world, however, on these rights of the Lord Chevron for more than 10 years, even had Chevron oil tanker named after the Condoleezza Rice, Andrew Carr, the GM lobbyist, and more. Is it any surprise that they're hungry for oil? That's a joke. The kid saying his father was our oil boom in their town. Might explain something of U.S. relations with Iraq to Venezuela. But a side effect of the administration not responding to the devastation of this cultural capital of the country and our world, and I hope it wasn't because it was majority. But a side effect of not responding is when the corporate media did the right thing, they just went down to New Orleans. There were no troops to invade. And we saw perhaps for one of the first times corporate media reporting from the victims' perspective. And it was the same. We saw the bodies floating by on our TV screens. The Bush administration leading into action, they tried to again say we're not to fill the box. And the editor of the Times said, you've got to And then, from the bodies floating by to a young woman reporter, a man walked up out of the water with his boy holding his hand. He said he was in the attic. And as his wife's hands slipped away from him, she said, take care of the children. And this is the story of an actual reporter. And in shock, he just waded off into the water with his boy. And then we're wishing him. This is reporting from the victim's perspective. Ground zero reporting. And the effect across this country, it didn't matter if you were conservative, Republican, or progressive, or Democrat, or independent, politics, and nothing to do with it. People were horrified. How could this happen to an American city in the 21st century? Could you imagine if we saw these same images in Iraq, day after day, for just 1 week, babies dead on the ground, women with their legs blown off from hospitals, soldiers dead and dying, for just 1 week? I really do think that Americans are a compassionate people, and they would say no, war is not an answer to conflict in the 21st century. Just getting to the end of that letter that Carlos John Two just talked about a story we did a few weeks ago about Brian Gerard. Some of you might have seen or heard or read. He's the Rocky blogger that's right in the middle of blogspot.com. His analysis of Islam and Iraq, what's going on, the politics, the war, what's happening. But he's come to this country, he's got a green card, and he's living in San Francisco. And he was taking a plane from Kennedy Airport to San Francisco. And he was about to get on, and so four security officials from JetBlue and TSA said that he wouldn't be allowed on the plane with a t-shirt that he was wearing. His t-shirt was black and it had white letters, and it said, "We will not be silent." And he said, "What's wrong with my t-shirt?" And they said, "Threatening." And he said, "But it just says we will not be silent." And they said, "It's not the English, it's the Arabic script." And he said, "Oh, well, that's just Arabic, but we will not be silent." And they said, "Well, we can't go to that because we don't have to translate." They said to him that wearing a t-shirt with Arabic script on an American plane today is like walking into a bank with a t-shirt that says, "I am a robber." He asked if Arabic can talk to Arabic language, and he tried to fight back to say it's a constitutional right. He's now a taxpayer. He should be able to go on this plane, but it didn't look like it was going to happen. And JetBlue officially said, "Why didn't the TSA pull this stop a t-shirt?" And they wanted to know, he said, "We were on it." And they said, "If you don't put this cover t-shirt with this, you're not getting on the plane." He thought it was an important issue, not one to be deported for or to go to Guantanamo for. And so he put on the t-shirt. And they escorted him on the plane first. He had reserved a seat in front, where he likes to sit, but they brought him to the back without saying anything. And then the rest of the passengers were allowed to board, and in blue sense. So we told the story in the next 2 days riot. And the next day, someone in a tour studio, we were at a 100-year-old firehouse in downtown Manhattan, just as we lost ground zero. And they walked in, and they were all wearing a t-shirt. And I started asking them what they were doing, and said they had to leave, they were racing to the airport, and I said, "Where are you going?" I said, "It doesn't matter, okay, I'm fine." Against reason alone. Thousands of people in this country have been detained since 9/11. This country is the greatest democracy on earth for some. But for others, it's a very dangerous place. And we have to stand together to make it more difficult for individuals to be isolated. You know, there's a saying from World War II, Pastor Martin Niemoller, first they came for the socialists, it was the social soviets, the gap, then they came for the trade unions, it was the trade unions, soviets, the gap. Then they came for the Jews and the Catholics, it was the time they were soviets, the gap. And then they came for me. I was invited on MSNBC to talk about Ryan's story. And the host of the show said to me, but I mean, in this day and age, we may not like Rich Brooke, but it isn't necessary. And I said, actually, no, if you're talking about the security of this country, in fact, it's very harmful. How will we catch the next Olympian again? And remember what happened after he blew up the Oklahoma City building. I mean, it was pretty clear, and others who were working on that. Did anyone suggest that all blonde-haired, blue-eyed white Russian men should be rounded up in this country? If you believe in law and order, that has to do with doing a criminal investigation, and if you find enough evidence, you charge them, you try them, and if they're found guilty, they should be punished. But rounding up whole populations is not just morally or principle, but if you want to just talk practical terms, when you alienate people, when you marginalize people, you're going to make this country more dangerous. Not only inside, but outside. Think about the rest of the world and how it leads us. David Holt's story of Mahara are completely vindicated by this Canadian inquiry, this judicial inquiry. What have we come to represent the rest of the world? Probably for Americans, the invasion is represented by the statute of say, well, there are thousands of times. That's how many times I've been on TV, and that's what we remember. But the rest of the world has a very different image. Perhaps it's a picture that Iraqi lives in. A hood over his head and arms like out in a Christ-like fashion with electrodes dangling from his fingertips, standing on a box. That's probably the symbol of America and the engagement to the rest of the world. We need a media that bridges the gap. We need a media that tells the truth on the ground. There is a very important lesson to be learned here in Chicago. I was just speaking at WDON Voice of the Nation, and I was talking about coming here today and thinking about Gaines Mobley. And when 50 years ago that 14-year-old boy sent money in the city by his mother here in Chicago so he could be outside the city for the summer, and he's lynched, he's killed by a white mob to take evil whistles at a white woman. He was 14 years old and ends up in the bottom of the river. And when his body was sent back to Chicago, his mother engaged in a very great act. She said, I want his casket open. I want the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of hatred. And thousands screamed by that casket. Jet Magazine and other black publications printed photographs of Paul Emmett's distorted, disfigured head. And it was seared into the memory and history of this country. What Mamie Tomoe did is a lesson to the press of this country. It is not our job to whitewash images because they are ugly. It is our job to go towards whatever is there to show, and the people in this country can make up their own minds. Information is powerful. The media are the most powerful institutions on earth, more powerful than the bomb, more powerful than a missile.
for the state. And I also want to note someone important in this audience, Tony Lauderanis, if you'd be willing, if you would stand up. We write about Tony in Static. He came on Mom to Seattle, made an enormous impression, one that I think listeners and viewers will not forget as he spoke to the hour about his experience in Iraq as an army interrogator. And ended up by saying, I'd like to apologize to Iraq. He said, to the military guys in Iraq, I would say follow your conscience. Don't do what everybody else is doing just because it seems like that's the right thing to do. It's not. That is very brave to speak out. But after one day, we had a lawyer, she was poppysilentemail.com, however they can learn any different languages, and however they get Farsi, sometimes television will show the Farsi and talk about the Arabic, but anyway. And then Spanish, and French, and Hebrew, and however you said they make them in the original German. Where did that come from? It came from World War II. The White Rose left. A brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl. They were not Jewish, they were German Christians. And they thought, what could they do in the face of the atrocity? They started to get out pamphlets about what was happening. The fourth pamphlet said across the top, we will not be silent. Hans was a visual capture by Nazis in Germany. But that motto, that philosophy, is one that should be adopted by the press today. It should be the media's Democratic vote. We will not be silent. We will not allow those who are targeting this country to be silenced. The people who believe in peace in this country, and they are across the political spectrum, every stripe, every sector of society. Yesterday afternoon, I was in Sarasota, and a boy came up. He was 15 years old, he was in a military uniform. He said he came over from Sarasota Military Academy and talked to him as a shaker program. The people who believe in peace in this country are not a fringe minority. They are not a silent majority. They are a silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, and we have to take it back. Very quickly, I'm talking about 9/11, September 11, 2001, that we're at the moment. We were broadcasting Democracy Now! The second plane, the second tower just lost from Ground Zero, close to National Broadcast of the World Trade Center. And we were not aware of what was unfolding outside at the time, we were in the attic, no windows, and we were doing a special that day on a connection between terror and September 1973. The day South Korea began. The democratically elected leader of Chile got in the House as a finishing force to force power, the U.S. Act finishing force, the Nixon Act, Kissinger Act, IGT Act finishing forces. They reigned for 17 years, killing thousands of Chileans. Tomorrow is the 30th anniversary of the murder of Ronnie Moffitt and Rolando Letelier, the Chilean diplomat, who were killed in Washington, D.C. My bomb was placed under the car around a researcher with the Chilean diplomat, Rolando Letelier. We'll have Rolando's son on tomorrow on Democracy Now! It's 30 years later, far of the handshake killing machine, his father, the victim. But September 11th is not the first time that date was connected to terror. September 11, 1991, all the anthropologists were in that, died at the hands of Guatemalan security forces, U.S. September 11, 1977, in South Africa, Steve Biko, the founder of the Black Consciousness Movement, was being beaten to death in the back of a van by apartheid forces, U.S. apartheid forces. He died in the early morning hours of September 12. And just having been in Minneapolis last Friday night, I learned that lead filters were in place September 12. The Native American leader who was in prison for decades. And I bumped into his lawyer, Mike Guzman, that day. He had just gone to a federal court in Minneapolis where they were applying for 90,000 pages of documents in Felder's case. When they had a trial decades ago, they got 1,800 pages. They thought that was it. Now they're applying for 90,000 pages, and that's just from one FBI office in Minneapolis. And they've been denied based on national security reasons. Leonard Felder has been in jail for 30 years. September 1971, Agatha, the uprising upstate New York prisoners protesting prison conditions. 2 days later, then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller opened fire, killing. Now, then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller called out the New York State Troopers to open fire, killing 39 men among the guards, critically injuring 88 others, and wounding hundreds of others. In fact, just this week, the guards' families have won a victory in terms of seeking compensation. More than 35 5 years later, when at the time they were told that the prisoners had killed their husbands and loved ones, the coroner's report suppressed that showed it was a bullets from the guns of the authorities. September 11th is not the first time that our came to U.S. soil. I'm saying African American about slavery, I'm saying Native American about what happened in this country. But it was a horrific moment, 3,000 people incinerated in an instant.
Americans!
We'll never actually know.
Yes, we will.
How many people died on that day? Because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death, and they were the undocumented workers who worked at the World Trade Center. And we should know their names, and we should know their stories, because that's what dignifies a life. Mm-hmm. In the days after September 11th, we hunkered down in the firehouse. Because as we saw the war machine gearing up in Washington, the picture of what was happening at Ground Zero was very different being projected to the rest of the world than what we were experiencing. There was a little sticker that we saw that said, "Our grief is not a cry for war." And then there was very much a feeling. Thousands of people to the parks in New York holding candles and flowers and talk and cry and debate and discuss. It was not a feeling of one of us. And yet that's what was being projected, the danger of the corporate media being projected to the corporate friends. And then we broadcast the voices of people like Rita Lazar. She was 7 years old, she lost her brother Isan. I was on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center. He was working next to his best friend, and he was our paycheck. They both worked for Blue Cross and Shield. And he brought a string to them on the cell phone together. He said, as soon as the emergency workers come up and help Ed, we'll go out together. And they died. It's funny. A few days later, President Bush gave his national cathedral address, and he wrote the story of the calling the National Bureau, and I raised it now. And she wrote a letter to the New York Times that actually got published. She said, he initiated the worst pain of life. It would not lessen the suffering to know that a mother, a woman in Afghanistan, was soon to spread. She says, not in my name. Not in my righteousness. And a nationwide movement grew up, not in our names, but in our love, that is peaceful tomorrow. At that time, there were these pictures that went out all over. You could call it the 9/11 wallpaper of New York. Thousands of Xeroxes of color photographs of love. Everywhere, car finishes, lampposts, the size of hospitals, everywhere. A picture of a woman holding her child and say, if you have seen my wife, please call her husband and a phone number. Or a picture of a boy, say, if you see my son, last seen in Tattoo, please call his mother and a phone number. And I thought about how similar those pictures were to those carried on the placards by mothers who disappeared in Argentina as they walked the plaza of the line. Have you seen my grandson? Have you seen my granddaughter? September 11th united us with people around the world against terror. Terror is the killing or terrorizing of innocent civilians, whether done by individuals or done by states. We have to have a uniform standard of justice, yep. Which is why President Bush has signed the ICC Treaty, the International Criminal Court Treaty. It's fine for them, but not for us, not for U.S. officials and U.S. soldiers. Now, this endangers us all. It matters what we do in this country. We come from the most powerful country on earth. We pride ourselves. We are a model for the rest of the world. But if we model torture and this extraordinary term, extraordinary rendition, which translated from the White House into English is kidnapping, translated in many Latin American as disappearing people. If this is the behavior we model, then we from this country, when we travel abroad, citizen or non-citizen, we have a decision to make every hour of every day, whether we're journalists or students, professors, doctors, nurses, shopkeepers, truck drivers, artists, soldiers, ROTC recruiters, whether we're employed or unemployed, retired or just starting our careers, we have a decision to make every hour of every day, whether we want to represent the sword or the shield, Democracy Now!